was a quiet boy who didn't think very critically about the world. His father was a scientist, his mother a radical, and his best friend easily took advantage of him. He was witness to murder and sex trafficking and the apocalypse and what came after. And importantly for our podcast, he described, well, Margaret Atwood described through his memories, a society that took biotechnology to such an extreme that it destroyed the world when things went wrong. You see, in 2003, Margaret Atwood, author of The Handmaid's Tale and many other transformative dystopian books, set her eyes on another type of dystopia in her novel Oryx and Crake. The first in a trilogy, the novel follows Jimmy and his role and experience in this apocalypse. We see a futuristic society where massive corporations are able to engineer almost any bioengineering feat imaginable. We see casual bioterrorism and engineered chimeras that serve as pets, like Jimmy's pet Rackunk, which is half raccoon and half skunk.
Wow.
And we see things go very, very wrong. Like, nearly the entirety of all humanity dying out wrong. And you learn that very quickly, I promise, it's not a spoiler. In the novel, Atwood provides a pretty dire portrait of the society's downfall and even its peak. And one creature that plays a major role throughout the book is the Pagoon, which is this massive pig bred and raised to grow human organs. Atwood describes,
"The goal of the Pagoon project was to grow an assortment of foolproof human tissue organs in a transgenic knockout pig host, organs that would transplant smoothly and avoid rejections. Now they were perfecting a Pagoon that could grow 5 or 6 kidneys at a time."
Back in 2003, when Atwood published the book, using transgenic pig organs in humans was a scientific dream. Yet, on April 4th of last year, 21 years later,
this morning, Rick Slayman is waking up in his own bed after receiving the world's first successful transplant of a genetically modified pig's kidney into a human.
Suddenly, putting pig organs into humans isn't a futuristic story. It's a story of successfully getting a man off dialysis. Suddenly, this technology is being talked about not in terms of how it could ever be implemented, but when it will be scaled up. Suddenly, Margaret Atwood's Pagoons take on a very new meaning and urgency. And today, we'll be talking about just that. Hello and welcome to Dystopiascope. My name is Gabriella Folks, and in this episode, we will discuss the recent porcine kidney transplants that took place last spring in the context of Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake. We'll talk about the motivation behind this technology and the science that made it possible. And then we'll take a dive into the possible futures, using the literature to better understand the hopes for a utopia and the potential for a dystopia. We'll start our story on a typical misty Boston day last spring, when Mr. Richard Slayman left Mass General Hospital with a genetically modified pig kidney in his abdomen. 62 years old at the time, Mr. Slayman had been suffering from end-stage kidney disease, had been on dialysis, and time was running out, faster than he could get a new human kidney. And so on March 16th, 2024, he underwent a 4-hour-long surgery conducted by the Mass General Transplant Center and came out on the other side with an organ from a pig. This surgery was a huge deal because it was the first time a patient successfully received an organ from a pig and was actually able to leave the hospital a considerably healthier person. Now, before we get deeper into his story, you may be thinking, wow, that is a pretty extreme procedure. If we're at the point that we're sticking pig kidneys into humans, the situation must be pretty desperate. Well, you'd be absolutely right. And the motivation behind this whole ordeal lies with the rampant and devastating international organ crisis. Within the United States alone, more than 100,000 people are currently waiting on an organ transplant list, with the vast majority of those patients in need of kidneys. To put that another way, that long wait means that 17 people die a day while waiting for an organ. This need for organs arises from a whole slew of health issues, from diabetes to high blood pressure to a number of diseases, disorders, and infections. And unfortunately, the list of patients needing organs continues to get longer and longer. This rise can be attributed to a number of reasons, but for example, end-stage kidney disease rates are expected to rise in the United States by 29 to 68% by 2030. Of course, with such a terrible crisis, there are many ways that people are trying to address it and mitigate the damage, such as by educating people about organ donation and extending the criteria for suitable donors. They're also using more controversial methods, such as the acceptance of presumed consent, rewarding families of donors, and even restarting blood flow to a recently deceased person to better preserve the organs, which in some cases has even restarted the heartbeat. But despite all of these efforts, at the end of the day, there simply are not enough suitable organs to meet the demand. And so scientists have expanded their attention to making something that a human could use as a kidney. I know that sounds a bit Frankenstein-esque when I put it like that, but that is where this crisis has led us. This strategy has included trying to get cells to form an organ in a petri dish, building a synthetic organ, and of course, using animal organs. To get a better sense of what this thought process and this scientific process actually looks like, I schlepped over to Charleston Navy Yard to speak with Joran Madsen, director of the Mass General Hospital Transplant Center, which you'll remember conducted the kidney transplant we're discussing today.
So we call this the Center for Transplantation Sciences, and that's because we do more than just organ transplantation. We do quite a wide range of experimentation that goes on here. And we use animal models, anything from a mouse to a baboon. The non-human primates we use as surrogate human beings, the closest we can come to human beings, in attempts to develop techniques that will save human lives. And at the end of the day, that's what this is all about, is trying to save human lives. The good news is that a lot of people are being saved right now through transplantation, but the unfortunate thing is that there are just not enough organs to go around. And so this particular area that we're talking about today, xenotransplantation, is trying to address that problem by using pig organs.
A quick note here, you'll hear the word xenotransplantation a lot during this podcast. That word refers to a procedure where cells, tissues, or organs are transplanted between species. So this porcine transplant is an example of xenotransplantation. I asked Dr. Madsen if he could talk some more about Mr. Slayman's case in particular and how they decided to move ahead with the procedure.
He was in a very unfortunate situation where he had been provided a kidney transplant many years ago at MGH. It failed. He has severe diabetes and hypertension. And he was back on dialysis because that kidney failed. And the problem was, because of his diabetes and hypertension, the blood vessels that are used for the catheters that are required in dialysis, hemodialysis, those blood vessels were diseased. And he was going into the hospital very frequently to get revisions of the catheters that are required for dialysis, to the point where it was compromising his lifestyle. And we were running out of places to implant these catheters for dialysis. So he was not a candidate for another kidney in the near term. We calculated that if he was on the waiting list, he would probably die before he got another kidney. So that constellation of scenarios led to the decision to approach him about the possibility of doing the pig. And he was a very intelligent man. He thought carefully about it. He learned about it and finally made a decision to go forward.
And so, with this approval from Mr. Slayman, as well as the center's IRB and experts they brought in to analyze Mr. Slayman's condition and the FDA, they moved ahead with the transplant. And on April 3rd, Richard Slayman was successfully discharged from Mass General Hospital, the world's first living recipient of a genetically engineered pig kidney. Mr. Slayman issued his own statement expressing that this was one of the happiest moments of his life. He was deeply grateful for his care team at Mass General Hospital and excited to be free of dialysis. Sadly, nearly 2 months later, Richard Slayman passed away. His family issued a statement of mourning and expressed further gratitude toward his care team at MGH. They described his legacy as one of hope and inspiration for patients, researchers, and healthcare providers. Mass General Hospital also issued an expression of sorrow, as well as the statement, quote, "We have no indication that it was the result of his recent transplant." Indeed, as they found no evidence that his body rejected the kidney, it appears that the transplant was not the cause of his death. And that's what really makes this case so remarkable. People have been playing around with blood transfusions from animals to humans since the 17th century, and a number of attempts were made to transplant organs in the 20th century. But you can imagine that without the scientific understanding of organs, antigens, diseases, etc., that we have today, results were largely not great. Even in the early 2020s, for example, two landmark surgeries took place where a pig heart was transplanted into a human. Unfortunately, both of those patients passed away just a few months later due to heart failure and rejection. While Mr. Sleiman passed away in the months following his surgery, his story is one of success, as it did not result in his death and in fact improved his health in the months following the surgery. Three other patients have received pig kidneys since Richard Sleiman's procedure last March. In April, a second patient, Lisa Pisano, became the second recipient of a genetically modified pig kidney, though her case was less successful. You see, Pisano also needed a heart pump, and ultimately her blood pressure dropped too low, which injured the kidney and made it lose function. Surgeons had to remove the failing organ after 47 days. Importantly, this kidney also did not fail due to rejection by the body. And as for the other two patients, one of whom received their kidney in November and the other one in late January of this year, both of them are living as of this podcast's recording in February of 2025. We see some differences across these four transplants, but largely there's the same strategy. Of the four transplants, some of them were conducted at Mass General Hospital and others at NYU Langone Health, and the genetically modified pig kidneys came from two different companies, eGenesis and Revivicor. We'll be hearing specifically about eGenesis' strategy later on in this podcast, but just know that there's generally the same strategy across the board. Okay, so at this point, we're seeing a lot of success and hope with this technology for solving or at least alleviating the organ crisis. But like I talked about earlier, this isn't the only strategy that scientists are pursuing. So at this point, I was still feeling a bit confused about why they decided to pursue this xenotransplantation over some other technology. So I asked Dr. Madsen.
So no, it's as I look at it, there's a race going on to address the problem of end organ failure. And one way to address that is through bioengineering, you know, constructing organs, generating organs, 3D printing, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one category. Another category would be machines. In heart transplantation, there are some artificial hearts that people have been using, and that's something that's getting better and better. And then there's xenotransplantation using pig organs. So that's the third participant in this race. The fourth is curing the disease that's causing the organ to fail. And in the last 10 years, we've seen that. We have now a cure for hepatitis C, which was the major cause for liver transplantation. No longer, because we have drugs that can cure hepatitis C. And cystic fibrosis, one of the major causes for lung transplantation. Again, we have new drugs that can deal with that. So those are the four different, if you will, participants in the race. And I would say, at this point, of course I'm biased, but I think xenotransplantation is winning the race right now. I think the strides we have made that you've heard about are just, in fact, I never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. I have to admit that up until a few years ago, I was a naysayer. I didn't believe in xenotransplantation. There used to be a lot of jokes. For instance, xenotransplantation is the future of transplantation and always will be the future. Or there are three major principles of xenotransplantation and we don't know any of them. So I was in that camp, but then CRISPR-Cas9 came along and that changed everything.
So CRISPR was when you started to believe it was?
Yeah. We're now, you know, some of the pig organ we put in to Mr. Sleiman had over 60 gene edits, which is almost like science fiction to someone as old as I am.
Almost almost like science fiction. I couldn't agree more. The idea of genetically modifying a pig kidney and sticking it into a human being to save their life, that reminds me of a science fiction novel I'm hoping maybe you're thinking back to.
Let me refresh your memory.
The goal of the Pigoon Project was to grow an assortment of foolproof human tissue organs in a transgenic knockout pig host.
Yeah, remember Atwood's Pigoons that grow 5 or 6 human kidneys at once?
Okay, I know I'm kind of harping on this science fiction angle, but I'll also point out that xenotransplantation has been around in literature for a very long time, and not just in science fiction.
So let's think back to Greek mythology. Imagine Icarus and his wings of bird feathers and wax. His father took parts of an animal and grafted them to his son, which fits our definition of xenotransplantation. These narrations about xenotransplantation are in mythology, in religion, of course in science fiction, and they develop alongside the technology. So as more attempts were made at xenotransplantation, and as, you know, surgical processes were more refined, we see the process becoming a little bit less hazy in literature. So for example, in Mary Shelley's 1818 Frankenstein, the doctor acquires animal parts from the slaughterhouse as materials for his monster. Of course, she doesn't go into tremendous detail about the doctor's scientific process, but you can see how this is a step more technical than Icarus's wings. And so when Margaret Atwood comes along in 2003, she's building on a legacy of literature and scientific developments to craft her rampaging Pigoons. She was looking around, observing society past and present, and from that painted a portrait of a futuristic society controlled by and obsessed by biotechnology corporations. And importantly, she does so to catastrophic ends. And that leaves us in an interesting position. We've just heard about the devastating organ transplant crisis and about how hopeful scientists are about this xenotransplantation. We've learned about how much unique potential this technology has for saving lives. But we're also faced with stories like that of Oryx and Crake, with this thought experiment of a future where things go so wrong. And I know for me, this intersection of ideas left me a bit confused. I couldn't shake the question, could we be heading for a dystopia similar to that in Oryx and Crake? Okay, that is a huge question. And first things first, to even begin answering it, I really need to give you some more context into the Pigoons of Oryx and Crake. So in the novel, Jimmy, our main character, has a father who works at Organ Inc., which is where they make and care for the Pigoons. They use the Pigoons to grow all sorts of human tissue organs, like kidneys, livers, hearts, and later on, Jimmy's father actually moves to a new company called New Skins, where they even grow a human epidermis. Jimmy and his father actually live on an Organ Inc. compound, which is pretty common in this dystopia. So that means everyone in the entire neighborhood are employees at Organ Inc. or their families. And this living situation arises for two big reasons. One, there's a very prevalent fear about biosecurity at a company like Organ Inc. So at this point in time, a whole slew of viruses have mutated to be incredibly dangerous, and so they're worried about that getting onto the compound accidentally. And then they're also worried about sabotage from other companies and some sort of bioengineered virus that could attack their Pigoons. And the second reason for them living on this compound comes down to control. Everything at this point is done in-house on these compounds, and that's very common for these big bioengineering corporations, because they're large enough, they're powerful enough, and they're rich enough to run an entire town's worth of employees. I'll also add that all of this manufacturing that they do of the Pigoons is done through genetic modification, and because these Pigoons are chock full of human cells, they're oddly humanoid. Especially post-apocalyptically, we see this kind of eerie human intelligence coming through in these bulls, which, yeah, is definitely creepy to read about. Okay, that's just a very broad summary, and I'll give you some more details soon. But even now, we can tease out three big themes. Firstly, biosecurity. Secondly, the humanness of the pig. And thirdly, control over the technology. And why I think Oryx and Crake is so pressing even today is that these three anxieties map pretty well onto the real anxieties that people have expressed about xenotransplantation,
those are still prevalent anxieties in 2025. As we try to understand our own potential futures, I'd like to take a closer look into each of those three themes: biosecurity, humanness of the pig, and control over the technology. To do that, we're going to examine Oryx and Creek some more, look at sources for concern in 2025, and talk more about the underlying science to better evaluate what really warrants our worries. Okay, right off the bat, there are, of course, some obvious differences between the pigeons and current practices. The pig used for Richard Slayman's procedure donated just one kidney and was not a suitable donor for all of that other stuff that a pigeon could produce. And while the pigeons of Oryx and Creek were massive, the actual pig species that was used, the Yucatan miniature pig breed, was actually quite small so that the kidneys were the right size for a human. For the more nuanced differences, however, we need a better understanding of what really happened scientifically. So I reached out to Mike Curtis, CEO of eGenesis, which is the company that made the pig kidney last spring. We've heard the term genomic edits thrown around a lot at this point, and the first thing I wanted to know was, what are they actually doing to the pig?
Oh, thanks for the interest in what we've been doing at eGenesis. So our whole approach to genome engineering starts with a single porcine cell. Right, so we start with a wild type, typically a fibroblast, sometimes we'll use embryonic cell, and all the editing is done to that single cell population. Right, so in the case of the donor that was used for Mr. Slayman, that donor carried a total of 69 edits. So those are all, you know, germline edits. And then through that editing process, and typically we'll go through three rounds of actually gene editing on the cells, we then make a clonal population of cells. And then establish essentially a cell line that carries all the genetic modifications that we want. And then from that cell line, we then use a process just similar to technology that was used to clone Dolly back in the 90s to make a clonal porcine donor, right? So all that work is done using oocytes sourced from a clean herd. Then we use, you know, our clean engineered cells to make embryos that we then transfer into surrogates. The piglets then come to age, takes about 4 months. And then those animals, now fully genetically engineered, are then allowed to age out. And in the case of Mr. Slayman, that donor was about 12 months old prior to donation of the kidney for transplant. So we do the genetic engineering once, establish the cell line, and then from that cell line, we can really make an infinite number of porcine donors.
Okay, he just gave us a lot of great information, and I want to break it down some. So at eGenesis, they take a wild-type cell from a pig, and they conduct a series, 69 in particular, of genomic edits on it using CRISPR. CRISPR, or CRISPR-Cas9, in case you didn't know, is a technology that was first published in 2012 that's used for highly controlled edits of a genome. It's derived from how bacteria react to new viruses. So when bacteria face a new virus, they take a little piece of viral DNA and they actually store it in their own genome, kind of like a library, so that when they see the virus again, they can recognize it. And so using this system, scientists were able to develop CRISPR-Cas9, which is a way to do this with extremely high precision and control. So they can insert desirable genes with high precision. And so eGenesis used CRISPR to establish a genetically modified cell line of actually clonal cells. So all of the cells have the same DNA, and all of those cells have these modifications. And then from that, they make clonal pig donors. So this means that all of the pigs have the same genetically modified DNA in them. And this also means that once they've actually done the gene editing, they can just keep on using that same cell line to make more and more pigs through cloning. You can imagine that by just using clones, they have gained even more control here because they're not going to like accidentally breed in some problematic gene because all of the pigs have the same DNA.
Okay, so multiple pigs would be coming from that individual cell line.
Yes. Yep. So I think to date we've made, well, you know, over several hundred porcine donors using that process.
And you mentioned a clean cell line. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so one of the biggest concerns around xenotransplantation is the potential for zoonotic transmission, you know, transmitting pathogens from the porcine donor to human recipients. So we do a lot of work to control any pathogen risk associated with any of the materials that we use in producing the porcine donors. And in the case of our engineered cells, we test all of those cells to ensure that they're pathogen-free. We use an unbiased screen to search for not only pathogens we know, but also potential pathogens that we're not looking for.
Okay, so we're starting to get some more details into the first anxiety that we identified, biosecurity. Biosecurity is a very big theme in Oryx and Creek. In this futuristic world, viruses have mutated to be incredibly dangerous. So I mentioned earlier that Jimmy and his father live on a compound for the company Organ Inc., but all of the people that don't live on compounds live in what they call the pleblins, which are these very impoverished and lawless areas outside of the compounds. And those areas are stock full of horrifically deadly diseases. And we see at many instances that people on the compounds are scared of some sort of breach, that viruses from the pleblins will get onto the compound. Importantly, the institutions in the novel also have such control over the biology that making deadly viruses is within reach. So throughout the whole book, even outside of the Pagoons, biosecurity is a big and salient theme. But in terms of the Pagoons, we get a pretty close look into the fears regarding biosecurity. We hear the following description pretty early on of Jimmy visiting a Pagoon farm in his youth.
The Pagoons were much bigger and fatter than ordinary pigs, to leave room for all of the extra organs. They were kept in special buildings, heavily secured. The kidnapping of a Pagoon and its finely honed genetic material by a rival outfit would have been a disaster. When Jimmy went in to visit the Pagoons, he had to put on a biosuit that was too big for him and wear a face mask and wash his hands first with disinfectant soap.
In the novel, the company that makes the Pagoons is terrified that some disease or other could get into their livestock. So that's why we see Jimmy wearing his biosuit, and at one point we even see them burning a gigantic pile of cows and sheep that had gotten infected with some newly manufactured disease. And Organ Inc. has to be really careful because they want to keep their livestock healthy and they need to avoid passing something onto the humans. I'll also add that this second worry of transmitting a disease from a non-human animal into a human, zoonotic transmissions, is pretty salient in conversations about xenotransplantation. I mean, even outside of xenotransplantation, people are worried about it. We just recently heard about the first bird flu death in the United States following an outbreak last year. The thought of, you know, being exposed to an animal and picking something up from them is something that has people stressed, reasonably so. And when we talk about xenotransplantation and putting something inside of you, that anxiety is heightened. So people are definitely concerned about zoonotic transmissions. That said, we just heard from Dr. Curtis that eGenesis is being very careful and thorough in screening for pathogens and even things that could potentially become pathogens. But screening for pathogens is not all they're doing about biosecurity. The strategy that eGenesis is taking actually goes all the way down to the genomic edits.
And so then you landed on those 69 gene edits that were present in the pig kidney that went into Mr. Slayman. So how do you evaluate what is a necessary edit, what's overkill, and like how do you be selective about that, but of course also rigorous?
Sure. So, you know, we've come into this field after 30 or 40 years of research by the transplant community to try to understand what edits need to be made to the porcine genome to improve organ performance and long-term outcomes. And so our 69 edits are comprised of really three different classes. The first and most edits is to inactivate endogenous retroviruses. So back in the mid-90s, it was discovered that endogenous porcine retroviruses, which are present in every pig breed, have the potential to infect human cells. In the mid-90s, we were coming out of the HIV epidemic, and there was worry of another retroviral transmission, right? So it really slowed the progression of xenotransplantation because in any pig breed, there are anywhere from 60 to 70 copies of this retrovirus. And until the discovery of CRISPR, there was no way to edit them out. What George Church and Luhan Yang showed at Harvard was that you could use CRISPR to inactivate all these 59 copies of the virus and produce viable pigs. So 59 of our 69 edits are to inactivate retroviruses. And then the next three edits are to improve carbohydrate compatibility between porcine donor tissue and human recipient. So if I were to take a wild-type pig kidney and just simply transplant it into a person, it would be acutely rejected in minutes to hours. And that's because there's preformed antibodies in humans against carbohydrates found in the pig. We knock out three genes responsible for those carbohydrate differences. And once you do that, you eliminate hyperacute rejection. And that's been shown now in several patients that have received modified pig organs. So that's three of the edits. And then we add seven regulatory human transgenes. And these transgenes regulate coagulation compatibility, they regulate complement activation, and they also regulate mechanisms of innate and adaptive immunity. Now, these genes individually have been shown to improve outcomes in xenotransplantation. We take them all collectively and add them as a group. And then we're the only group in the world that has the retroviral inactivation technology, which we think is incredibly important, especially as we think about bringing this technology to hundreds of thousands or millions of people. The risk of a zoonotic transmission just goes up with the number of transplants that we do.
What kind of facilities are you keeping them in terms of like preventing outside illnesses from getting in?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So we have two levels of what we call biosecurity. So we have a research facility where we make larger numbers of animals. We hold a relatively high level of surveillance in that herd. But then we have a second facility, which is called the barrier facility. That's another level higher in biosecurity, where we control very rigorously all the air, water, feed, and personnel that come into that facility. And in that facility, we consider those animals pathogen-free, right? So that prevents any cross-contamination from another pig, a person, anything. So those are the animals that we intend to take to the clinic. So maintaining these very high levels of biosecurity, we've been able to keep what we call a clean herd. Now, there's as you can imagine, there's a consistent monitoring program that we have on the herd, right, to ensure that if we do see a contamination in the herd, that we can deal with it. We see this even in the agriculture industry. When you look at the health standard of the porcine population in the United States, we hold it to a very high standard already. What we do is then take it up a notch to an even higher standard for animals that are going to be used for organ donation.
Okay, so that is a lot of information there. And he certainly addresses at least two of those three anxieties that we saw in Oryx and Crake. He definitely talked about biosecurity some more. And we also got some more insight into the human features of the pig. He mentioned the three classes of gene edits that were used in Mr. Slayman's porcine donor. First, inactivating the porcine endogenous retrovirus, which they call PERV. Second, modifying the antigens displayed on the pig cells. And third, inserting seven regulatory human transgenes. And all of these gene edits are done using CRISPR, which we talked about earlier. So let's break that down some. Firstly, PERV. This fits in with what we were talking about earlier with zoonotic transmissions. And PERV comes up a lot during conversations about the controversies of xenotransplantations. It's frequently pointed to as a reason to not pursue xenotransplantation. So the way a retrovirus works is that a virus comes in contact with some cell that it's attacking, and it inserts a chunk of RNA and an enzyme called reverse transcriptase into this host cell. That RNA and enzyme work together to create DNA that is complementary to the viral RNA. And then that DNA is integrated into the host cell's genome. So essentially, it is permanently editing the host cell, the cell it's attacking, permanently editing that cell's genome, which is very bad, as you can imagine. HIV is a very well-known example of a retrovirus. And pigs have tens of copies of this retrovirus in their genome. So that's the first class of edits, taking out those genes. So in terms of threats to biosecurity, it seems like things are under very firm control right now. So eGenesis is screening for pathogens, many times. They have their pigs in a tightly controlled facility that prevents contamination. They're inactivating the retrovirus to ensure that there's no chance of humans getting that from the pig. It seems like things are pretty tightly controlled at this point. The second class of edits that he talked about were modifying the antigens displayed on the pig cells. So way earlier in the podcast, when we were talking to Dr. Madsen, he mentioned rejection quite a bit. Rejection can happen for a wide number of reasons, and a very important one is the expression of certain antigens in porcine cells. So for example, porcine cells display alpha-gal, certain glycan antigens, and humans have antibodies for those very antigens. So if someone were to stick an unmodified pig kidney into you,
your body would attack it and reject it. So the second class of edits is to remove those incompatible antigens. And then the final class of edits is the insertion of these 7 human regulatory transgenes. And that brings us to our second anxiety, the humanness of the pig. So in Orcs and Crake, the Pigoons are hosts for human organs. So they are growing literal human tissue made of human cells with human DNA. And this makes the Pigoons customizable. So some patient could request an organ and have a perfect match with their own DNA made up for them. But it also makes the Pigoons eerily humanoid. So later on in the post-apocalyptic portion of the book, we encounter a scene where Jimmy is hiding from a group of Pigoons.
Those beasts are clever enough to fake a retreat, then lurk around the next corner. They'd bowl him over, trample him, then rip him open, munch up the organs first. He knows their tastes. A brainy and omnivorous animal, the Pigoon. Some of them may even have human neocortex tissue growing in their crafty, wicked heads.
They are clever, they are vicious, they are anthropomorphized. Here, reality and science fiction diverge quite notably. So in reality, these pigs are growing pig organs. They are made compatible for humans through genomic edits, and they are selected to be the right size for humans, but they are porcine tissue. The final class of edits that eGenesis does is take chunks of clonal human DNA that they gather in essentially a plasmid of about 30,000 bases and insert that into the pig's genome to improve various aspects of compatibility between the human recipient and the pig donor. The human transgenes do make the pigs a bit more humanoid, you could say, because they do have some, you know, human DNA within them. But eGenesis's pigs, they're not growing human cells and human tissues. It's not like these 7 genes could somehow give pigs this kind of human intelligence that we see in Oryx and Crake. So at this point, we've addressed the first 2 anxieties. Biosecurity is a valid worry, and if things weren't under control, things could go wrong, but right now it's looking really good. Scientists, they're editing out the retrovirus, they're screening for pathogens, they assay for pathogens in the cell line, in the piglet, in the organ, and even in the donor to ensure that the results are stable. The cleanliness from pathogens is highly controlled at this point. Furthermore, regarding the second anxiety about the humanness of the pig and mixing human and pig genes together, we don't really have any cause for concern here. The pigs at eGenesis grow pig kidneys made of porcine tissue. They do insert those 7 genes from human DNA into the pig, but a human has something like 20,000 protein-coding genes. It's really not like these 7 genes could somehow give the pig human intelligence like we see in Oryx and Crake. You'll remember that Revivicor is another company I mentioned that's producing pig kidneys. I won't go into too much detail about their process, but do know that it's fairly similar. They use a different pig breed, which has larger kidneys, so they include genomic edits to make the kidneys smaller. And then they also take a different strategy for which genes to target. So they only make 10 genomic edits. So this brings us to our final concern regarding the power over this technology. We just heard Dr. Curtis discuss a streamlined process with this porcine kidney production. We're really getting a closer look at the academic research and industry crossover. They have facilities across the United States, they've tested over 20 versions of the edited pigs, and they've established the cell lines that we discussed earlier. At this point, eGenesis is building off the science and really looking into optimization and how to do this kind of process on a large scale, safely. They're also still heavily integrated with the hospital and other research institutions, and are of course working with the FDA. In Orcs and Crake, though, we see frantic independent companies that are running off to do wild modifications of animals, all for profit. So, for example, earlier I mentioned Jimmy's father moves from Organ Inc. to New Skins, where they're using the Pigoons to grow a new human epidermis. There are companies growing chickens for meat. There are companies making all sorts of random animals, like the ratkunk that Jimmy has. And throughout the novel, these companies are really seeming independent. They seem to run the entirety of the society. Employees live on compounds for these companies. And when these companies go head-to-head, it gets really ugly. So we saw with that bonfire at the beginning of the podcast that it's kind of questionable that, you know, maybe another company infected the compound with a virus in order to kill out their Pigoons, that kind of extremism. So just like with the biosecurity and the humanness of the pig, this portrayal of corporate control that Atwood puts forward is pretty terrifying. And so at this point, as we try to evaluate where we're heading, we need to know a little bit more about the next steps with this xenotransplantation technology. So as we talked about earlier, Mr. Slayman was in a really tough medical spot, and it was unlikely that he would get off the human transplant list. But you can imagine that companies like eGenesis are intending to use this technology on a much larger scale. So the next step in this process is actually starting a formal clinical trial with the FDA. And that would look like enrolling a handful of patients that are also in a pretty bad medical situation. So older patients, patients that had already received a kidney, patients that historically don't get off the transplant waitlist. After running this trial and hopefully seeing success, the group of eligible patients could then expand. So one big thing that they're aiming for is to use this xenotransplantation of a kidney before the patient goes on dialysis, because dialysis can actually be very detrimental to the patient's overall health. You can imagine, with how many people are currently waiting for a kidney, that to get to the level of preemptive transplants, of being able to give a patient a kidney before they go on dialysis, we're going to have to produce a lot of pig kidneys. And then as this technology sees more success, it's also feasible to imagine more doors opening, other types of transplants being made possible. And again, that would require more pigs. And so my final question for Dr. Curtis was, what does scaling up actually look like?
Yeah, so when we look at our portfolio right now, our what we call our eGen 1784 donor, so this is the donor that donated the kidney for Mr. Slayman, we're using that same genetics in our liver perfusion program, as well as our heart transplant program. So from that single donor, we can harvest at least two kidneys, a heart and a liver. So we're currently planning the scale up of production. And if you look at the scale that we need to achieve, which is in several hundred thousand animals a year, it's still orders of magnitude lower than what's typically made in the ag industry.
And for anyone unfamiliar, the ag industry is short for the agricultural industry.
Right, so we can use our ability to produce animals at scale in the ag industry as a barometer to say, okay, we know we can make animals at scale, right? What's the scale we need to achieve for xenotransplantation? And we think it's in range. So our goals right now, we're planning what we call the 1,000 donor facility. This facility will allow us to make 1,000 animals a year. And then from that, we can continue to scale up. So there is absolutely, a scale up that needs to happen. And that will be done in the context of how things progress clinically. Because our next goal here in the next 12 months is to initiate clinical studies across the platform, right? So additional studies in kidney, our first studies in liver, as well as our first studies in heart transplant in patients.
A quick note here, this interview with Mike Curtis was conducted in July of 2024, so adjust that 12-month time frame accordingly. Okay, so it seems like there's definitely big plans to expand into other organs, to look into more facilities to get larger with this technology. And at this point, when we're evaluating the anxiety about control over the technology, I find it more difficult than it was to evaluate the biosecurity and the, humanness of the pig. When I think about biosecurity, for example, I feel calmed because I know that it's under really tight control right now, that people are paying a lot of attention to it. But that ultimately comes down to who controls this technology. So when we think about this final anxiety about control of the technology, I get a bit more worried. I can totally envision a future where this control is diluted, where it's spread out. And if that's the case, then those anxieties about biosecurity and, humanoid pigs become more salient. And that's where I really start to lean on stories such as Oryx and Creek. So up until this point, we've been throwing around the idea a lot of, what did Atwood depict about the future? What aligns and what misaligns with what actually happened? And I think it can be easy when reading dystopia or talking about science fiction to think about it in terms of a prediction. So it's easy to think, oh, well, Atwood predicted this and she got this right, but she got this wrong. And that's really not what the science fiction is about. Ursula K. Le Guin, a renowned and transformative speculative fiction author, coined the phrase, science fiction is not predictive, it is descriptive. And I think that's really important in our conversation today. Back in the early 2000s, when Atwood was writing this novel, she was looking around herself and noticing the scientific and technological developments of the time. She was seeing how capitalism manifests in certain ways. And she gathered all of that information and she decided to write it down in the form of a dystopia. And that's not to say that Atwood wasn't making any predictions. Back in 2003, she was aware of attempts to grow organs for humans in pigs. She was aware of attempts to grow animal protein in petri dishes. She knew what was going on scientifically and kind of extrapolated about where it could be going. So there are definitely elements that are somewhat predictive, but ultimately she was describing the trends and tendencies that she saw around her. When I was researching this podcast, I wanted to know more about what that actually means, to be descriptive but not predictive, as the concept seemed pretty important for understanding what Atwood was really getting at with her depiction of control. And so I reached out to Neil Mukherjee, a fantastic and awarded author and an associate senior lecturer of creative writing at Harvard. And I asked him to connect the dots a bit, to contextualize Oryx and Creek in that philosophy of Le Guin's, that science fiction is not predictive, but descriptive.
Le Guin, I think, in that introduction she writes to Left Hand of Darkness, says that, no, I'm not trying to predict anything about the world, she says. It science fiction is descriptive, but description is not entirely free of other intellectual pursuits. Description can be something ideological or something political. Description of the world, necessarily imagined or real, has to account for what the world is. And if that is not politics, then I do not know what politics is. So I feel Le Guin is kind of being a little naughty, I think, there, saying science fiction is not predictive. She's right. Science fiction is not predictive in the sense that it does not set out to say, right, I'm going to write something that is going to account and tell you what the future is going to be like. No. Science fiction is extrapolative, like Darko Suvin says. You create an imagined society from what you have, and it's more like what she called a thought experiment. So what Atwood does is she was prescient rather than predictive. She saw that these corporations are amassing more and more power and more wealth. What would happen if they acquired more power than nation states or acquired more power than governments? It is the case that there are individuals or corporations that are moving towards such power. We could say that how much Meta is worth or how much Musk is worth is much more than the GDP of several nations I can think of, you know. So she thought about that and took that to an extreme point. The question is whether that extreme point is believable or not. In her case, I feel it's partly believable. I think, you know, she was thinking about cloning, she was thinking about genetics, she was thinking about corporations doing this to experiment with the world. So I'm thinking, what is to prevent someone as powerful, and we know that wealthy and powerful corporations can have a deleterious effect on democracy. They can hijack organs of political decision making. Pack it with their own people, pay off people. Lobbying is a very benign term for such things. And then they do something for which the consequences might not look so different from the world that Atwood paints, the picture that Atwood paints in Oryx and Creek. So that's what I meant by thinking not predictive, but extrapolative, thought experiment.
After this conversation with Dr. Mukherjee, and as we wrap up our episode today, I'm left wondering about the future of control over this technology. When we think about the scope of the organ crisis and the long history of allo and xenotransplantation, we see how incredibly transformative the porcine kidney transplants from the spring truly are. Centuries of science have brought us to this moment, to this technology that could save thousands and thousands of human lives. We are at this critical precipice where we finally understand the science enough to pull off such a feat and to do so safely. We understand the biosecurity risks. We understand how to harness the similarities between a pig kidney and a human one. We understand what we can control and where the risks lie. In Oryx and Crake, we don't see a full picture of how Earth got to the point that it did. We don't fully see how these biotechnology corporations took such complete control. We do see, however, how things get out of control. We do see how frantic pursuit of profit through the Pigoons and other technologies becomes world-threateningly dangerous. And as we think towards our own future, towards our own use of this technology, it is critical to monitor that control. It's unfortunate to say, but while the organ shortage is tragic for some, it is lucrative for others. It is a crisis that involves a lot of desperate people and a lot of money. In the current political and economic landscape of the United States, it's plausible to see control over this technology shift. During a time of upheaval of longstanding laws and regulations, during a time when wealthy investors and CEOs have infiltrated the federal government and the distinction between billionaire entrepreneurs and politicians appears to be disappearing, during a time when science itself is too frequently being brushed aside, it's becoming easier to see how our society could meet a similar fate to that in Oryx and Crake. With control and caution, this technology has astounding potential. But if we lose sight of that larger picture and the risks that science warns us of, then all could be lost.